Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The author of the true crime classic Lobster Boy now turns his investigative skills to the chilling true story of Kendall Francois, one of the most bizarre serial sex killers of modern times. In October 1996, young, pretty, and petite women began vanishing off the streets of Poughkeepsie, New York. Most were prostitutes and some were addicts. By August 1998, the toll had reached 8, when a prostitute told police that she had barely escaped being strangled by Kendall Francois, 27, a 6'4", 300-pound middle school hall monitor, whose slovenly personal hygiene had earned them the nickname Stinky. Inside his house, the smell was much worse, as investigators discovered a tangle of rotting flesh and bones, 8 female corpses, almost all decomposed. The book that we're featuring this evening is Body Dump, with my special guest journalist and author, Fred Rosen. Welcome back to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview. Fred Rosen.
Hello, Dan. How the heck are you tonight?
Very good. Thank you very much, Fred, for doing this. It's, again, going to be a great show because this is another you've uncovered or another incredible tale. So let's talk about we had spoken last night, so we'll let the audience know that.
Set. Yeah, we just have to admit this. We spoke last night, and the entire conversation was about Deflategate, and we're working on that, folks. We just want to let everybody know that we're going after Tom Brady. Okay, just let you know this stuff. You know, this is a combined international operation, you know, and we're going after him. So we just thought we'd let you know this stuff. I'm sorry.
Kind of serious stuff we're now working on, yeah.
Well, you
Fred,
know what?
With this
you know
book,
what? Yeah.
Go ahead, sir.
No, I was just going to say, you know what it is? I learned years ago from some cops and then prosecutors, Dan, that when you work murder cases, if you don't kid around, you're going to go nuts. You got to kid around. You know, I mean, that's one of the hard parts when you're writing a book is, you know, the cops are not going to tell you the jokes they said. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But because they're just trying to keep alive, and because, you know, they're affected emotionally by the cases, the good ones, that's when they solve those cases. So I don't know. I just put my 2 cents in on there and that.
No, I spoke. There was a particular case, again, in my hometown where there was a recorded version or a reported version of a police officer in this little out-of-context recording was that he had no regard for the murder victim, and they were made
really,
a nickname
Dan?
Up for it. Yeah. But as I've learned over the years, and it keeps getting reinforced, there's always two or three different sides to a story. So a police officer that noted that it was posted said, yeah, but here's the real story. And so the real detailed story was of a cop saying, yeah, this, you know, this, what do you call it, gallows humor. And the reason why even there was
gallows
a lot more, there was a rationale for why even the joke was even said. And so an explanation, we'll say. So two different stories,
you know,
really.
No, man, that makes a great point, you know. I mean, here we are in a situation, you know, where it doesn't make any difference what the case is. As soon as it breaks and it's about murder, you see it all over the place without having the source is checked out and so forth. And then what happens? Perception becomes reality, you know? And that
makes
it, man, does that make it difficult, you know, when you're investigating something, whether you're a cop or whether you're, you know, a reporter, or, you know, or maybe one of the Avengers. You never know. Hey, I got that in.
There you go.
Sorry.
With this
Actually,
book,
I'm not sorry.
With this book, Fred, which was interesting is that in our conversation, we just touched on something that normally we don't talk about so much, and we really get to the nuts and bolts of the story, and we certainly will to this one. But I want to ask the first question is, why don't you explain how involved you were in this story, what you had to do? You talk about having to move to this town. Tell us why. Tell us the whole, and you talked about, ask me about how I got some of these interviews or the people I had to speak to, and the idea that you were going to write a book about an African-American serial killer. So tell us a little bit about that before we start.
Well, let me just say to people that it's wonderful that you're listening in, because Dan and I are able to actually communicate before we go on air, and we're not setting up shtick, which I would do with other hosts. What we're doing is we're actually talking about how we're going to spend your time and the information we're going to give you. And so what happened with me was that when this case broke, that is when Kendall Francois was captured, and he gave a confession in which he said he killed these women. And what happened was I happened to be living at the time about 30 miles away. This was a very, very unusual circumstance. It'll never happen again, and nor do I want it to, because it's nice to keep this stuff, you know, at arm's length. But what happened was, I read this, and it said, you know, this dude who was captured, who was a serial killer, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, gee, man, you write true crime, you're supposed to investigate this. So I went from where I lived to Poughkeepsie, and I started looking into it. And I did a proposal on the book, and I sent it into the publisher. But what happened was, at the time, it was so horrific, Dan.
Right.
I'd never worked on a case that involved more than one or perhaps two victims. Yeah, two victims. So I said, oh, man, this is not my cup of tea. And simultaneously, the other thing was that I had been told by editors at two different publishing houses, major publishing houses I'd worked for, to never touch a case involving an African American. And here I had a guy who was accused of being an African American, a serial killer who was African American. So I said, well, you know what? I don't really care what his race is. It's a good story. Let's investigate. And I went ahead with it. And originally I wasn't going to write it. A former student of mine was going to write it, but he couldn't do it. And at the last minute, I stepped in and I wrote the book. And in order to write the book, I had a problem, and that was that it was hard to get people to talk to me about it. So I got a job teaching at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York, for a year, during which time I taught at Marist.
Wow.
And I went out on the street, and I talked to the people involved in the case.
Incredible.
I don't know. Well, you know what? It was weird. I don't know what else to tell you. I mean, you know, it was close to me. You know what I mean? I mean, you know,
right.
I mean, we're talking serial killer, and here I'm this, you know, true crime author, and this dude is almost in my backyard,
mm-hmm.
and he was a particularly, you know, his nickname was Stinky Guys. I mean, you know, the original title of the book was Stinky, and I guess, thank God, the editor changed it to Body Dump.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I mean, this guy, I mean, just think about that, you know? You know, it's really strange. And the older part actually has a lot to do with what happens later on.
Sure. Well, let's start at the beginning because we talk about Poughkeepsie, but we also have to talk about Highland and then its connection to Poughkeepsie and then how small is Highland and really what does Poughkeepsie represent, because that's the, you know, the crux of our story here is the, not the divide, but the contrast, I would say. So let's talk about Highland and its small population and then the bridge Poughkeepsie and the difference.
You know something? I have to tell you something, Dan. I knew that we were going to be doing this interview. And it happens, I still live in the area. And I had to go down from where I live to New York City to tape a TV show for Investigation Discovery.
Right.
And I went through Highland, you know. And I've been down that road. It's from, you know, for a long time. It's 9W in New York State. And the thing is, Highland is a very small town, you know, off of Main Drag, basically.
Sure.
Do people still say that, Main Drag? Main Highway. And there is a string of hotels there. Still there. I looked the other day, and these hotels are catered to prostitutes. Still the same, you know. And across that, and then what happens is when you go a little bit further south, you get to the Poughkeepsie Bridge, which then goes across the Hudson River to the city of Poughkeepsie, which is on the east bank of the river in what's called the Hudson Valley. Now, that city is not quite a city. That's where it gets confusing. There's the city of Poughkeepsie and the town of Poughkeepsie. Dan, these guys must be up all night in this stuff, you know? How do you figure this stuff out? Okay, in other words, now you got yourself three different police forces in the same place. You got county, you got city, and you got town. And that helps when you're a bad guy like Kendall Francois, who's moving from one to the other. And when I say one to the other, folks, I'm talking one city block, okay?
Wow.
So what we're saying here is that you have a serial killer who's able to operate partly because of geography and because of, you know, whatever these arbitrary, you know, boundaries that have been made for tax purposes,
right.
You know. So, you know, this is the place that he was working in, and I would I was teaching at the school, and I'd go out, and I, you know, after I teach, and in the afternoon, and I sort of, you know, ride around, and I would do, you know, I started to do my interviews with Bill Segrist, who is the lieutenant in charge of the investigation, who's really responsible for bringing this serial killer to justice. And what would happen is, he and I would go down to the Hudson River. Think any river. It could be the St. Lawrence. I don't care what it is. And, you know, it could be the Mississippi. It could be the Ohio. And we'd go down and we'd look, you know, he knew the right deli to go to. So we'd get some really good, you know, sandwiches. And I'd talk to him. And he would tell me about the Kendall Francois case. And he told me all about how, you know, he started getting into it and so forth. And this took about a year to get him to trust me.
Now, you start off introducing, of course, the victims and then portraying what information you find out about these poor souls that end up first usually a drug addiction and then this low-track prostitution. And you first talk in your first chapter, you talk about Wendy Myers.
Right.
And so she has to, she gets a ride over this Hudson River here into Poughkeepsie.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about Wendy Myers and her, a little bit about her background, how she ends up where she is.
Well, I mean, like a lot of the, one of the commonalities that I found when I did my research into the backgrounds of the victims who were prostitutes was that they all had problems, and eventually those problems led them to drugs in the street. And the part that I really found interesting was the fact that in most instances, police will look at prostitutes as second-class citizens. So they're not all that interested. You know what I mean? They don't have regular jobs. They don't pay taxes. They're not looked at as being a regular person. And it takes a unique personality like a Bill Segrist and a Jimmy Ayling, who are two of the cops in the story, to look at these people as human beings. And then by doing that, they're able to eclipse their similar background. Again, it's going to be drugs, you know, and leading to prostitution. And take it to the next step, which is to find the dude who did it. And that's what I found really nice, which was that you had people that would do this.
For the sake of going through all the stories of all the victims and not to, you know, just brush over their lives and their deaths in this story. But this, talk about Kendall Francois, who this guy is.
Yeah.
You said he's a stinky guy, he's a huge man. But you go back into the book and talk about his earlier life. Even at the time, he's living with his parents. So you would talk about his early life. So tell us a little bit about Kendall Francois.
Well, one of the problems, first thing is that one of the problems in this particular case is that the perpetrator's family has not made any public statements regarding him. And so therefore, you know, you go with whatever the record is. So what we know for sure is is that he grew up in a house with his parents and his sister. And this is Poughkeepsie, New York. And so we know that what he did with the bodies was to dispose of them in the house. And I get into that, obviously, in the book. And, of course, the real question then comes in, okay, you're taking seven bodies, because the eighth was never discovered, and you're putting them in a house in the middle of a town, okay? Okay, people next door and other people, you know, other people smelled something, but yet the family never made any statement about, you see what I'm saying, about smelling anything. Now, I'm not implying anything whatsoever. I'm just stating what we know as public record. So, excuse me. So, what we have here is a situation where this guy is growing up. We don't have much in the way of background. We just don't. Which is a shame. you know, but we just don't. What we do know is that he winds up going and becoming a middle school monitor. We're not talking about, you know, some guy from Deliverance. We're talking about guy's got a brain. But for some reason, he has a problem with hygiene.
And there's no incidents, that, like you're saying, he's an intelligent guy, so we're not with this, he's got this appearance, he's a huge man, like you say, 6'4", 300 pounds, but he's got an incredible hygiene problem, and this is a long-standing hygiene problem. It continues through his entire life to the end of the story here.
Yeah, very good point.
You do talk about
very
him being taunted for being fat and overweight, so he certainly wasn't, he didn't have an idyllic life growing up, but he, like you say, he does amount to something, and there's no real incident in contact with police in terms of him being some kind of creepy hall monitor type guy.
Yeah, Dan, that's a very, very, oh my God, wow, that's an incredible point. Folks. Our host just pointed out that there's no evidence whatsoever that the serial killer ever was a person who molested a human being. This is, and you know, I hadn't even thought about that, but that's excellent and that's true. There's nothing there. However, there is a however, which is that, oh boy. When I was researching this story, the dude wound up in Hawaii in the 1990s in the Army. In my fantasy, Dan, comment at any point, I was ready to call Steve McGarrett at Hawaii 5-0. However, since that doesn't exist, you know, I just, you know, made a call to the Hawaiian Police Department, and the reason is, in Honolulu, rather, because there was a string of unsolved serial killings of women there at the time Kendall Francois served in the Army. They never got the bad guy. And I got information later after the book was published from somebody that seemed to implicate him in that. You know, and you know how it goes. You know, when they bust you for serial killing over here, the cops over there try to, more often than not, it's something else, but sometimes it's you know, legitimate.
With this, what's interesting, too, is all the, when we're going to be talking about the polygraph incident.
Man.
And what's interesting about that, you could almost go off on about 100 pages on, you know, how many cases hinged on that, how many police officers take that as gospel and eliminate a witness. And there's scores of books where that would be the case. Well, my God, he passed a polygraph with flying colors. And so we'll talk about that. Let's first talk about the MO, because, again, when somebody's looking at crimes in Honolulu later, if the MO is not similar, then that's going to be something that's going to eliminate that as a possibility. So let's talk about Stinky's MO, and what was he interested in life when he was a predator
on
the streets of Poughkeepsie?
And what we know is, and the reason we know this is because he confessed, and then the forensics backed up. It was a situation where they really didn't, once he confessed, because of the differences between the town and the city, it was a different, you know, one police force caught him for stuff he did in the other jurisdiction. They interrogated him, but they didn't interrogate him a long time, which is what they should have done. Okay, you know, you get as much information as you can. But in any case, they
They got lucky.
Out. Well, they got very, very lucky. Boy, I didn't say that. Yeah, they got some advice from the. I mean, it's an unusual. You know what? Here I go. I'm going to put my my 2 cents in, and then all the people that have bashed me in the past on your show for saying something about the FBI can do it again. And what happened was the FBI gave them in Poughkeepsie some advice, and the FBI said, "Hey, set up a roadblock," which they did. And as a result, actually, in this particular case, it worked. A prostitute who'd been assaulted by Kendall Francois escaped and was able to get out of his house and, by coincidence, run into the roadblock. And that's what started the whole investigation going, which essentially included archaeologists.
You talk about, we just talked about the questioning, so we'll do that and then we'll go backwards because he does confess, otherwise no one would know a thing. There, Bill Sechrist is this key character in here too, and we'll go backwards too as how close with Cantella and the dog search that they had, the rescue dog search, and
right.
then Bill's ideas in retrospect. What could have been done before if they knew, if only they knew. So let's talk about when Francois is captured, because we've talked about that already. They do this. They do an interview, and it's, again, because of the jurisdictions, there's different police doing the interview rather than the people that were, like Bill, that were pounding the pavement. So these people, maybe mistakenly, but end up luckily later, they do this interview and just ask them about this rape of this Diane Franco, and
yeah, but
luckily they have a roadblock, and then a gas station agent says, "Yeah, she's just running down the street
right
now. She said she was raped by this guy." So, tell us about that.
Well, the thing is, before we go to that, I just realized I hadn't answered your last question, which was about, you know, in terms of, oh God, I'm losing my train of thought here. No, just in terms of, one of the things that's really interesting about this is how it was covered, okay? How do 8 women wind up appearing off the streets of a major American city? Nobody says a word. I mean, that's a lot of people, you know? And one of the things that happens here is because Francois is known, is a known John, they bring him in and they do a polygraph, a lie detector. And what happens? They say, "Oh, did you have anything to do with any of these women?" "No, I didn't have anything to do with it." He passed. This is a primary example of why lie detectors in the U.S. are not allowed that piece of evidence into a court of law, because a serial killer, a.k.a. a sociopathic murderer, can lie and get away with it from one of these machines.
Seems like it.
So... what was your question?
But the thing is, in continuance with that, Bill Sechrist, regardless
yes.
of that lie detector test, doesn't believe, he doesn't let Kendall Francois off the hook in terms of, in his mind, a suspect.
You know what? I looked at this guy when we were having that lunch, or lunches down at the Hudson River, and it was like one of those things where there was something inside, you know. There was something about this guy, and I tried to get that into the story, that he was going to let this guy, you know, get off. He didn't, you know, it wasn't a personal thing, but he didn't like the idea. You know, Francois was basically thumbing his finger in the eye of the cops. And so he just kept after him, even though he passed the lie detector test. Bill had enough, really, it wasn't, you know, he was humanity. He had enough humanity to say, you know what, okay, he passed the lie detector test. He's our guy. I'm going after him. I'm going to keep going. And it wasn't a situation where he, you know, he didn't violate his constitutional rights or anything like that. You know, he just kept looking at him. You know, is this the dude? You know, it's, I don't know. You know, maybe I'm wrong, Dan, but I just don't see that very often. That kind of dedication to duty. You know what I mean?
Well, there was, he has a personal connection, as you talk about in the book. He warns, I mean, it's a sad story, when he warns a girl that he knows, that he knows that, but, you know, again, you talk about his empathy for these people, because it's demonstrated in saying, hey, listen, there's a guy out on the street here. You better watch yourself, Cantina. You know, what are you doing, you know? And she ends up being, you know, victimized. And so he is that kind of person that understands the plight of these people, and he understands that despite the lie detector test, this is a hard-boiled cop that says, I just have a gut instinct. So again, it's very much like we think something out of movies where a cop just says, no, something in my gut. And you just get that in fiction, really, because that's not what they're really trained for. They dismiss stuff because they have to. They have to go evidence-based. They can't be going on gut instinct so much. Yet this guy is still doing it. So when they do get Francois in a room, despite those other cops' soft interview, he still has this guy as a suspect. And luckily, I guess all that energy, all that focus, Francois, what does, you know, you have to tell the audience what Francois does after this little interview, where he's waived his Miranda rights, so he will talk to these guys. They get him to write it out, then they get him to tape it. So they think the more he talks, the more details he's going to sink himself. And Bill Sechrist really wants to get to that house. And that's what you talk about in the book, too. You know, he wants to bring those dogs over there. And he's just certain in his own heart that this guy's guilty.
You know, I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm going, gee, that's exactly what I tried to write. and you know,
I did.
Thank you. But you know, the thing is, I don't. Well, let me just back up here and just say a few things. Which is working in. I don't think there's ever been a really good true crime book, a really terrific. And I'm not talking about anything I might do. About New York State, and I'll tell you why. Well, no, that's not actually true. No, I'm wrong. Serpico. Serpico is a great book by Peter Moss, okay? But the difficulty is that when you're working in New York State, there is this feeling that it's such a liberal place. That's not the case. It's the direct opposite. In other words, if you want to get information, it's incredibly difficult because it's really a very conservative place. So you have to keep digging and digging and digging to get to really what's going on. And in the case of Bill Sechrist, who is the detective on the case, he would not give up even when the lie detector was beaten by, in other words, that Kendall Francois was saying, I didn't have anything to do with any of these women disappearing, and the lie detector said yes. So he just kept going. And when he's finally arrested,
after a prostitute breaks free from you, and purely by coincidence they have the roadblock up, and then he gives statements to the police. Seagrass just wants to get into the house, which is what you're talking about, where you live. And they send dudes in with 5X suits. You know, it looks like something from a science fiction film. To find the bodies, or look, at least look for the bodies in this. Dan?
Yes.
Okay. That's it.
Your signal is really not great, Fred.
I'm sorry.
No, I just, I'm surprised. It's just for whatever reason, it's not a great signal right now, though.
I moved.
There we go. Yes, so sorry about that. I just kind of lost the signal here, and we'll get back on track here.
Dan?
Yes.
It's called editing, buddy.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So what you were last saying was in the interview, when he finally is finished with these police officers, but then calls the two officers back into the room to tell them to confess. Tell us about what he says and how he says it, and why do you think he even said it?
Oh, boy. Why?
Well, you know, why does a serial killer confess something? I think that there's a certain, you know, there's certainly a certain amount of ego in it. They had him and he knew he wasn't getting out. You know, that you got to look at that, about what he has done. And one of the things that we find is typical in the case of serial killers is they have very low self-esteem. Duh. So, you know, one of the reasons they do what they do is to attract attention to themselves. This isn't something that's done so that they're going to, you know, go under a rock someplace. You do this in order to call attention to yourself. Yeah, there's a certain amount of you know, the Man of Steel involved. They figure they're going to get away with it. I just realized something, Dan. I gave a plug to a really bad DC Comics. Okay, forget that.
Sure.
But they think that they're going to get away with it, you know? And they're not. But they have that ego that makes them think they are.
He does exhibit a strange personality in, though, that he, again, he's not, okay, so he thinks he's cocky, so he says, I'm not going to have a lawyer here, so I'll answer some questions. He then, and so then they don't really push him, because they don't ask him about the other murders. He knows he's a suspect, but they don't really push him. He calls the cops back in and says, listen, get a hold of the prosecutor, and I want to see some photos from 93. And they go, 93? That's incredible, because they thought maybe start killing in 96, as far as they know.
Right.
So they're excited. Then he takes four photos out of the bunch, and it's Wendy Myers, Gina Boron, Catherine Marsh. So it's all the victims, Sandra French. So it's all the victims that, or at least four of the victims that they were missing women, but it's odd that he doesn't go on to say, to brag like some of these people, or to really revel in the gore and the detail. He is a very unique in terms of serial killers, I would say, in terms of his behavior right then and there. Well, in terms of just that behavior, I think the murders themselves are not so unique. That's not so unique. But just this that one point of him, but then not going on like some guys wanted to publish books and revel in the details. So, and again, there was no impetus. He wasn't a good guy confessing or anything. It's not his Christian upbringing came out or anything. So I just thought that was very odd and unique.
That's a really good perspective. I don't know any other way to say that. You know, that's a really good perspective on this. He is, you know, an anomaly. Kendall Francois is an anomaly in many ways as far as, you know, being a serial killer. You know, one of the things I remember that really, you know, got me, you know, going was how the FBI, you know, their profile. Oh, my God. It's a white dude, you know. Everything is a white dude, you know, and I couldn't get over it. You know, it's like, excuse me, why couldn't an African-American be a serial killer? Well, they're telling Segrist to go after a white dude. Sorry, guys, that's not what's going on here, you know?
Well, the profile, as you talk about in the book, is really, profiling has ended up, and you explain in the book about unorganized and organized, and that's been repeated.
Yeah.
We won't get into that because that's a whole other book of people's egos and people trying to make money where they never made any money before. I think it's, but this profile especially is just so vague and so inclusive and includes so many people, and it really just what Segrist and these other officers looked at and said it was no value whatsoever.
Oh yeah.
In the end, it was a lot of luck. I mean, if you're going to put the confession in and Diane Franco running away from the gas station. Again, she wasn't going to try to run into the police's arms. And, you know, they had a couple close calls, but what was, again, it's crucial that they find out, and I mean, it's heartbreaking for the victims' families to find out what this, you know, Stinky did with their loved ones. You know, he paid for sex. At some point, he figured it wasn't enough. He was a huge man, even just to be laying on top of these petite women. And then the choking came, and he was a strong enough man to break their the hyoid bone. And so when he heard that, he was a very efficient killer. You talk about how he, again, with his parents living in the same building and neighbors, had five bodies up in the attic and then said, well, it's a little crowded. Let's start putting them in the crawl space.
you know what?
And
when I listen to you say it, okay, you know what? I think you should be you should work for the Crown, buddy. You know what?
Crown, yeah.
Because you sound like a prosecutor or a solicitor, one of the two.
Yeah.
I can say that, right?
Sure, sure. Well, I mean,
I'd love
to prosecute some of these people.
Well, you know what? You hit something there. When I was in the courtroom, oh my, when Francois was sentenced because it was a deal, and what happened, this was pretty damn interesting. New York at the time had reinstituted the death penalty. It's only about 15 years ago.
Right.
And what happened was, I'm sitting here and I still can't believe it. I mean, they wrote the law in such a way that serial killing did not qualify for death.
Right.
I am not making this up, folks. Okay? This explains why the New York Mets have gone since 1986 and haven't won a World Series. Now,
okay.
What I'm getting at is that what happens here is that the district attorney in Dutchess County, where this crime occurs,
he's trying to, like, push to get this guy death, and it's a waste of time because, hey, man, you got the law. You know, if you don't like it, change it. At the end of the day, they make a deal. They give Francois life without parole. What that allows is a sentencing hearing with witness impact statements from the families of the victims. I was in the courtroom, and I have never heard such affecting testimony in my life. I was in tears. I think anybody would be in tears. You know, and what that got, that's what made me realize that for people who write true crime books and report on crime, we're not doing our job unless we make the individuals, as we report on them, into human beings. That is, prostitutes are usually looked at by reporters in the same way that many cops do, which is a lower order of life. And I worked real hard to humanize the women who were the victims. And I was very happy that I felt that I succeeded. I even went to the cemetery of at least one of the victims, you know, where she was buried. And, I don't know. I don't know what to say, Dan. I just wanted to feel it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is, the indictment continues with journalism because, again, there have been cases where certainly the killer killed other people. That would be, I mean, the police state it, and they don't state anything they're not so certain of. Why would they? And so a good true crime book, an in-depth true crime book like yourself, where you've gone there, and that's why I'm totally supportive of and want to present to the audience books that are full-length, that are in-depth. If it's 500 pages to cover a case, then it's a 500-page book. If it's 300, but it's certainly not condensed versions or, you know, there's a place for those things, but I think there's a thirst for knowledge, and I know this audience has given me nothing but indications that the more information, the better. The more we get to know
about
the case itself, I mean, you have to. I mean, everybody's interested in the killers. Obviously, we remember the killers' names. That's who we remember.
Right.
But to understand the story, and that's what the fans want to know, the entire story. That's all it is. It's just history, and it's just harsh history. It's harsh reality.
Ooh.
And I'm sure it's certain that when parents read about their loved ones in a book, it's not the nicest thing, but they're probably not got any energy to be reading your book. That's the person who probably won't read it. You know, but there are other people need to know this information.
I can comment on that because over the years I've certainly had occasion to talk to on many occasions, the victims' families. And one of the things that I found was common was they would, well, I don't know if common is the right word, but a couple of times they'd say I was making money off the dead. And I remember saying to somebody on a book that I did called Needlework about people, somebody had gotten killed up in Michigan. And this person said that to me. I said, well, you know, you're making money off my sister getting killed. And I said, how come you gave an interview to the Detroit Free Press and you didn't think twice about that? What the heck is the difference? And, you know, and that's the point, you know. One of the things that I've always felt about true crime is because we're writing books, I've always said it goes into our, you know, Library of Congress. What's the equivalent in Canada, Dan? Library of Congress. What's the official library?
Yeah, I can't tell you. I can't off the top of my head. I probably can't tell you.
Well, what I'm getting at is simply that when you're doing this stuff, okay, and, you know, it goes across, obviously goes across international lines, and there's a lot of responsibility to get your facts straight because it's going to go into, you know, it's certainly on the internet all over the place, and so whether it's here or there or whatever, it becomes the version that is kept around. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you know, and the Library of Congress simply means they're gonna shelf a book on it. Now, in Kendall Francois's case, I have to say that the last thing I ever expected, absolute last thing, was the dude was gonna die. I mean, not, you know, in terms of life. I mean, last time I looked, everybody dies. I'm not sure about Doctor Strange, but that's another story. But I did not think this guy was going to die so soon, and he died, oh my God, less than a year ago in his early 40s. Yeah. And I did not find any, oh boy, I didn't, you know, it didn't make much sense. You know, I didn't read the autopsy report. I don't even know if they did one, but, you know, it was apparent, they said natural causes, early 40s. I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, well, the thing
yeah,
is,
no,
is that,
I mean, look, we're not, okay, I'm sorry.
No. Well, I mean, it's some people would like to see him live out his whole life in this 8x10. Some people would have liked to see something else.
Oh, boy.
But again, we're talking about an investigation that finally, luckily, I mean,
yeah.
God only knows how many more victims if this victim didn't get away. I mean, this guy had certainly to, you know, the capacity and the need and the want to be able to do this. Maybe not with every single prostitute, but, you know, his killing seemed to be accelerating. And
you just made a good point, and I didn't make the point. You just said that the killings were accelerating. And
well, you could see that
from
your book, you could derive that obviously every one of these victims, it seemed, already knew him. So it had numerous encounters with him.
Oh,
and then they get to the encounter
where,
you know, it's not working out. So
I'll never forget, you know, I got to tell you something. Again, it isn't very often, you know, that you wind up living close enough.
Mm-hmm.
Where one day you say, oh, you know, I, you know, in that particular case, I, you know, I owned a house and I actually had a lawn. And I said, oh, you know what, instead of mowing the lawn, I'm going to go down to Poughkeepsie and check out Kendall Francois' place. So I get in the car, you know, and I go down there. And now, you know, he's already in jail and everything. But I just said, you know, I just wanted to go over to the house. Oh, man. You know, I guess what you're thinking, you know, there's part of you that's thinking, oh, my God, there should be some, you know, a big hand, you know, finger in the sky pointing here or something, even though you know better than that. And you know what? All it was just a house in a very nice neighborhood, I might add. It was a detached house, a single family. Oh, man, it was two stories plus the attic and a crawl space underneath, which, of course, Kendall employed. And it had been boarded up because of what had happened. And you know what happened? Somebody came in and they bought the house at a song, redid the whole place, you know, on the inside, and sold it at a profit. You know, talk about, you know, the system working. I thought that was hilarious, you know. I just couldn't get over that, you know. One of the things I learned at some point in writing books is that, you know, about crime is that, you know, if blood gets on the walls, you don't get it off with anything. It seeps in. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I mean, that's like spooky to me. And but, you know, didn't make any difference here. You know, they were able to sell the house. By that time, of course, all the forensics were done and he was in prison and, you know, he wasn't getting out or anything like that. You know, that was never going to happen.
But we're talking about some very decomposed bodies in that house.
Yes, sir.
And that's what you say, the archaeologists have to come in and eight similar looking, similar small women down on their luck. One was just set to be a grandmother. Really sad story when you talk about, her name was Kramer, her last name was Kramer, but her mother was going to be a grandmother, and she was killed. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of days later, her daughter had what would have been her her first grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
The other one where Sigrist warns the young girl, Kanita, you know, there's a guy on the street, and then she's missing. You talk about, because there was people that survived, and based on the confession, so your book takes us right into what did he do? Well, he got in, Stinky got in. Everybody knew he had a hygiene problem. They didn't want to do tricks at a person's house. They want to make their money. And then when you talk money, I'm glad you put the sum in there just to let people know this sex trade work is $20. So
$20. Yeah. Well,
that's what we're talking
whatever,
about.
Yeah, you're not talking, you can adjust it for inflation. It doesn't make any difference. You're not going to come up with a lot of money.
No.
I mean, these people are just surviving.
Yeah.
And, again, talking about it, and I think about it, I guess what always bothered me was, you know, I went to, yeah, I went to, one of the victims lived in a town in the eastern part of the county, so I don't know, I had to drive, 80 miles, whatever. You know, I drove out there, and, you can figure it out, guys, 80 miles, whichever way you want from your house, it's still, a drive. I'll never forget that, and I looked up, and I don't remember which one it was, but the thing is, to me, one was the same as another. And I found the victim's picture in the local high school yearbook. And I made a copy so that I could have it. And I thought to myself, how the heck did somebody get from over here, 80 to 80 miles over there and on the street, selling their body, And there's a lot of reasons, that's another book, I think, but what was very clear was that Francois was a smart predator, advantage of people. And when I say took advantage, I don't mean just the sex for money. That goes on every day, and we're not talking about it, right? At least in this country.
Sure.
I'm talking about murder.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of the fact that of how these women are looked at, that they were able to disappear on a regular basis for 2 years before the police tipped to what was happening, let alone the local press, which I don't have any excuse for, quite frankly, because they were disappearing on a regular basis. They knew what was going down, And, this is the kind of situation, Dan, where if you're a local press and you know that this is happening, you report on it, and eventually it leads to the guy's capture, which is what happened, you win a Pulitzer Prize. That's not what happened here because they didn't report on it until after the fact.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it
happens
everywhere.
Am I going to get in trouble again, Dan?
No. No, absolutely not.
Well,
no, that's it's the same story with the media where I am in Canada. It's not any different. I mean, but, you know, it's a reflection of society, too. It's a reflection of society. I mean, certainly the victims are vocal. The families are vocal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, when, you know, the sad reality is, because a lot of people say, yeah, but your loved one jumped in a car with a stranger. And some of the police say the same thing. Like, my God, what am I supposed to do? How can I protect you if you won't protect yourself? And so you can see that sort of...
You know, I never thought of it that way. I never thought of it that way. Oh, my God. So that's what they're thinking, huh?
Well, that's what it is. I mean, but when you see a cop taking his job home, and these homicide guys do, in terms of there's a killer loose, and that's their job. They're on a task force to do this. I mean, it's professional, it's personal, if there really is anything that's both. And yet at the same time, people are still conducting themselves the same way in the same area, knowing that the predator's there because of their, as you explained in the book, their addiction overwhelms them. They have to do what they're going to do. This disgusting, dangerous, you know, they know it's dangerous to go to a John's home rather than a car. They don't have any backup system. They don't have a person protecting them. The police... Then when they try to find clues, when the person's missing and the family comes in and says, my prostitute daughter is missing, again, they don't make judgment, but then the families rightfully or wrongfully say, hey, you guys aren't doing enough. If it was a middle-class woman, you know, so that's what you talk about in your book. You say, listen, the cop is in between a rock and a hard place.
And then their only victory
is to see this guy put into prison.
Yeah.
But it's it's a thankless job, but thanks to books like this, audience like this that appreciates those stories. You don't have to be in law enforcement to understand these human stories. That's what I think people love about, if you have to analyze it, it's this all-encompassing human story. It's a sad, tragic story, but there are still people, even though it's futile, that are still trying to do the right thing. And part of it is writing about the right thing, the people that were heroes in this, if there is such a thing. Bill Segrist, another person named Manane, Bob McCready.
Well, who else?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you when you're saying nice things. Excuse me.
No. I'm saying that, you know, I just read this book fresh, so it is so fresh in my mind, and it's affecting me as these books do. These books affect a person, a reader, obviously, and they move on to the next one and get affected again. You know,
Dan, I just realized who you remind me of. You ready?
Who's that? Yeah, sure.
Dick Cavett.
Pardon me?
Do you know Dick Cavett, C-A-V-E-T-T.
Oh, yes, Dick Cavett, of course. Talk show
guy. You remind me of Dick Cavett. He was the most intelligent talk show host ever on television.
Oh, there you go. Well, thanks for the compliment. I don't know about Dick
Anytime.
Cavett, but...
Anytime, but I'm thinking, because you're really getting into some very interesting stuff. You know, when you talk about, you know, motivation, you talk about who somebody is as a person. That's the challenge when you're writing true crime. And, you know, the funny thing is, who was I talking to recently about this? I was talking to somebody about In Cold Blood. And they were saying some stuff that was negative about the way Capote did it, and what it really comes down to is, when you're writing true crime, there's a point where, okay, you got this fact, that fact, and whatever, but you're using the techniques of narrative fiction to tell your story. And so there is a tendency to go a little bit too far, that is, to fictionalize something without really having a backup to it. You see what I'm saying? And it's
sure.
A little bit here and a little bit there. And so it really is an area where the more you can keep your perspective, like a good police officer, a good attorney on either side, prosecutor or defendant, you're going to get a better story, you're going to get a more accurate story, and it won't, you know, it may not, it's not going to be as emotional, but you'll get it down a little bit better, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah, and it's a tough one. It's a real tough one, because I get affected by this as much as anybody else. You know, like, that got me, you know. I mean, going to the grave of somebody who's been killed by a serial killer, looking at the person's gravestone, thinking about the person. I never met the person, but I, you know, it doesn't make any difference. And I, you know, you start realizing, you know, the tragedy of this, and then multiply it by 8 plus however many more this guy killed, which we certainly suspect he did.
Was he eager to talk to the media after he was sentenced? Was there any possibility of having a serious interview with him?
No, what happened was he kept his mouth shut. You know, most instances, you know, your attorney's going to tell you to keep your mouth shut because you got life. And at some point, somebody from the city of Poughkeepsie, a woman, started corresponding with him. And this person wound up doing correspondence over a couple of years. I don't know how many, maybe it was 10, whatever. And, you know, he didn't reveal anything. You know, there was nothing significant about any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And then, he, you know, I think I can't, I don't remember the exact, you know, he died a year, less than a year ago. I think he was 44.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from quote-unquote natural causes. You got to wonder
what
about
was he,
that.
What was he like at trial, Fred?
Oh, boy. I just remembered what he was like at trial. Damn. Oh, my God. I'll tell you exactly what he was like. I was standing behind him. I'm sorry, I was sitting behind him. I was near the front. I was in the prosecution side was on the right side of the court. The defendants was on the left side of the court. No, I'm sorry, I got it wrong. The defendant was on the right. The prosecution was on the left. I was sitting very close to Francois. Is a film called Tom Hanks. Not sure what's the film in the prison.
Shawshank, Green Mile.
Green Mile. The thank you. The guy that played the part, he passed away too, of the killer. He was African American. In any case,
right.
That's exactly. In other words, Francois was huge. I'd never seen a bigger human being in person, except for Wilt Chamberlain, who was the center for Philadelphia. And this guy, but Wilt was thin. This guy was freaking huge. I mean, you know, he was 16'4" in each direction.
Yeah.
And the forget the
thing about the odor. What was coming off this guy was danger, fear. I'm not reading into it. I'm just telling you the God's honest truth. Okay? This was not somebody you wanted to meet in a dark alley. This
right.
guy was giving off the most. I guess I've been in a couple of courtrooms with killers, and you know, with serial killers too. And this guy, forget about it. This guy was, you know, this guy. Oh my God, it was bad. It was really bad. And when I heard all the stories that the survivors' relatives said, you know, as victim impact statements. I don't ever want to go through that again, Dan. You know what I mean? It's just too hard. I begin to understand why it is that seasoned detectives get to a point where they can't do this anymore. You know,
sure.
You get to a point where, you know, you can't push it behind you and be professional. You've heard too much of this stuff.
What was the media response? I mean, you talk about in the book where there was a smaller paper put out an article early on about
right.
missing women
right.
and nothing. No other media picked it up. They couldn't care less. And the public was not outraged, and they didn't. It didn't resonate with
yeah.
them either. Then later there was an article about the missing children, missing women and the serial killer on the loose. After this was all said and done, the confession, the sordid details, how did the local state media treat it, and how far did it go, and how big a story did it become? I know the answer.
Wow.
But how big did it?
Wow. Well, the answer is it didn't become a big story by any means.
Yeah.
It's now that we're talking about it, I was there. I mean, I experienced the local media, et cetera, and the answer is, it got picked up by the national media for 5 minutes. But
yeah.
the local media, no. By no means did they, except for this one small local paper, which I talk about in the book, go into a bit, which was good. There was another newspaper there, and I'm not going to mention it, you know, that was sitting on top of quite a case, and they knew about it. And they didn't do anything about it. And I don't know where to go with that except to say that, even the dailies, the locals, et cetera, and you're talking about an area of maybe, you know, let's say you went in a, how about a 35-mile radius?
Right.
Yeah, let's say 35 miles. You might have a quarter of a million people. You know, I'm not sure exactly. But nobody really reported on it, you know, on a consistent basis. Even when they knew what the heck was going down. Until, you know, in other words, people knew what was going down, that there was a serial task force, there was a task force to find a serial killer. But despite that, there was really no coverage. I mean,
yeah.
you know, you think about that, that's like ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
I mean, you know.
You know, it's testament, too, because, you know, serial killers, till just recently when spree killers have sort of replaced them as in vogue, and you know, just the emphasis in the media, because they are huge stories, not to say that they're not, but the serial killer has lost his luster a little bit in real life. Maybe not
oh,
fictional,
that's
you know.
That's good. You know.
But the thing is that you get a guy like this Francois, and he's not even on the serial killer radar, really. You know, he's.
Oh no.
I mean, he didn't have enough. I mean, 8 bodies. He's very serious. I mean, other stories have been called House of Horrors with a similar body count, we'll say, and the similar circumstances of bodies in garbage bags in a house. So I I always am astounded by how the local media is shies away from these local stories. Again, unless it's a, you know, a school girl that comes from a really good family, I think they're dead wrong in thinking that the audience, the meaning the reader, won't be interested in that. I think they've been wrong for years and years, and I think they're more and more wrong. They sound very, in terms of critical of certain members of society, where I think society has grown up and doesn't care if you're gay or transgender. I mean, you can imagine 5 or 10 years ago if a transgendered person was murdered. I mean, the emphasis or lack of emphasis or what they might say in a newspaper. You know, I think the society is, they're out of touch. And I think they're acting like, again, like elites. I mean, when you have prosecutors and you have police and you have rescue teams and you have citizens that are interested in the stories and victims and victims' families, I think we're more empathetic than the media takes. I mean, I just think they're wrong, and I think that's why they're failing anyway. It's because they're right off the mark.
You know, I could never be that eloquent, and I agree totally with what you say.
I'm outraged because they don't, I just don't think they share the same
values?
The same feelings as society, and I said that I think they're doing a disservice, and journalism is supposed to provide a service. They're not supposed to pick and choose stories, which country is more important to bomb or less important to bomb. I mean, this is not the case, or some people are less notable. I mean, they might have their agendas. They might have their biases, but again, that's why they're failing, because there's no connection with regular people and what they feel. I mean, you're still seeing Hooker dead. Why is one segment of society that I don't think should be considered lowlife, when you have all the lowlife in high positions, why somehow they have to put the word hooker, why they have to basically humiliate the family when they're a victim. And I mean, even our credible Canadian judicial system does lip service to victims and their feelings. At least in America, they're contacting them and saying, geez, is this deal okay with you?
But you know what? Now you get into situations where there's been an extensive amount of investigative journalism in the United States, surprisingly, about sexual abuse, specifically rape, of women on American college campuses.
Sure.
And the statistics they're showing are astonishing. Yet it's no discussion, except in a situation like this, where somebody like you is interested, and that is 1 in 4 of co-eds are going to be raped, 25%. Okay.
Yeah.
What do we call that? I call that an epidemic. What's the government doing about it? You know what I mean? I mean, it's a very, very, very interesting situation. And what we get into is that it comes down to dollars and cents, because a lot of times in these campus situations, it's athletes playing for big-budgeted NCAA teams that are raping women. Okay? It's a fact. So, what does that say? You know, I mean, you know, what it does is it devalues women, and it devalues, you know, we can go on and on, but, you know.
The thing is, though, I would say that I understand your point, but I think I want to say that I think the root of the issue still has to, it can't be the government isn't doing anything, because the government doesn't do anything anyway in this regard. It can't. It's just an institution. It's an institution.
Yeah.
It can enact certain things, but if society becomes a rape culture, has a sort of a rape culture mentality, I mean, rape is, what's disturbing to me is when I see a pedophile with, again, I call them a pedophile, possession of child pornography, and then the person says, well, not they're not a pedophile, they haven't committed an offense, and then the next thing I see many times is, oh, now someone's come forward and talks about, you know, assault, sexual assault and rape. So then those charges are there. There is a incredible connection, again, not a distinct correlation, but a disturbing connection between the capacity to rape and the capacity to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And once was a rapist is now a killer. And this story illustrates it as well. Once was a person that hated sex and dehumanized people and then became a killer. I mean,
boy,
to me, it's incredible that sex and sexual excitement somehow get all mixed up in murder, and that's where you get your sexual sadist, your sexual serial killer. So when I see rape on the rise all over the entire world, and this kind of bizarro war, rape, murder, that's the, again, a more, even more disturbing question. So rape is incredibly disturbing, and not, because I can see that many times, oftentimes, and it's a disturbing trend anyway, regardless, anywhere, under any circumstances. So, but it's even more disturbing to me. So,
Boy, that's a
but
good
point. But my point, I think I lost on this one thing that I wanted to say, though, was it starts off not in that athletes are more prone to rape, or people with money are more prone to rape. What it is that the people with money, the people with position, the people that maybe want to have a vested interest in having this guy have a scholarship and go on to professional basketball or professional sports, they have the best lawyer. So again, some true crime authors say, well, you know, you just don't understand. They're just doing their job. I keep going back to that point. It's right there. It's the lawyer does not take the poor black kid with no money and go all the way to the Supreme Court for free. He doesn't do it. But what he will do for a heinous criminal with money is everything. He'll put his arm around him. He'll be friends with him. And he's still a respected lawyer. I'm not naive as to what a lawyer's duties are, but some people make me sound like I'm naive as to their job. Their job is to be, you know, it starts with them and ends with them. It's three lawyers in the room. It's a prosecutor, it's a judge, it's a lawyer, and there's a lawyer. And that's the root of the problem. That's the root of the problem in justice in America, in Canada, and everywhere. They take fish. It's like a net. It's like a net in the ocean of dummies and losers. And people uneducated, and they throw those in jail as like a business. They do it here, too. It's not, the mafia is not in prison. The most serious criminals are not in prison. So what are we doing with prison? Nothing. We're not doing anything with prison if we're not.
I mean, that's a whole other ball game. What are we doing with prison? You know something? I will never, ever forget watching Nightline with Ted Koppel. I don't remember what year it was, but you remember that show?
Sure.
And Ted Koppel went into he was a hell of a good journalist.
Sure.
He went into a prison. He went into a prison with his crew, ABC TV in Texas. And they went into this prison with I think the guy was convicted of a sexual crime. Oh my God, this is incredible. And what Ted reported on was that they kept the lights on outside the cell 24/7 so that within 3 years the bad guy went schizophrenic. And
really?
And I came away from this. And maybe I'm off by a year, but that's what happened. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is proof that life imprisonment is worse than death. Look at what they're doing. Now, I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying it's constitutional. I'm not saying this. I'm not saying that. I just found it interesting that what they were doing, they were operating within the law. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
And they didn't, and they weren't, in that particular case, now, again, it's Texas, which, Cobble's reporting, this had to be in the 90s, because, I actually was in the town of Stark. No, was it Star? Help me out here, buddy. It's Sam Houston State University. That's not Star.
Can't help you there.
I was at Sam Houston State University in Texas. I don't recall the name of the town, but it was where they execute everybody.
Right.
There's been hundreds of executions. I got to tell you something, and I'm not, I was totally sober, I wasn't stoned, I wasn't this, I wasn't that, but I remember the vibe was really bad, and I wasn't there when they were executing somebody, I've never been in that situation. I thought about it, I thought about applying to see it and so forth. But I unless I have to, for some reason, I don't feel I'm going to do it,
No.
But it was very interesting to be in the place where, and again, I was at a conference. It was an academic conference. And, it was in between executions. It was a weird, Dan, I'm just telling you, man, it was just a weird one, I've never been in that situation, it's very odd, when you think about what I'm saying, this is a place where they've executed hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
The vibes are not going to be good,
No, I wouldn't think, no.
No, I'm, you know what, I think I better call on Captain America, I need some backup. Anyway,
yeah.
What's Steve Rogers doing these days? Do you know?
Don't know. Yeah. Well, Fred, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about this. I know we tend to go off as we do, and I hope the audience doesn't chastise us for it. But some people actually enjoy us going off on a tangent a little bit and just. Talking a little bit freely, maybe getting a little, we even got into a little bit touch of politics, and I know that's a taboo, but sometimes we have strong feelings, and instead of just sticking to the script sometimes. But I wanted to thank you for coming on and talking about Body Dump. For those that have listened, they'll want to go further investigate this incredible story. You take us right into this very, very sad and tragic story. Just a great story where the police finally do get a break, catch a couple breaks, and thank God the killer himself decided, weirdly enough, to confess. Otherwise, we wouldn't know the incredible, horrible story. But you've captured everything.
There,
you've got me going. When I read this book, it's just, again, I had to, vent for a half an hour about the system. It's just an outrageous, incredible story about a fascinating killer and the sad tale of all their victims. I want to thank you very much, Fred, coming on and talking about Body Dump. It's been a pleasure.
Dan, thank you very much. Hope to be back. And, your humanity is what I really appreciate. Thank you very much.
Well, really, Fred, you've done it because you bring to life these cases, and you're a champion of the truth, and that's really all anybody really needs, and that's what people are looking for in nonfiction. We're not looking for fictionalization, conversations that never occurred. We're looking for the stuff where you pounded the pavement, you talked to the girls on the street, the women who ended up being victims or could have been victims. You got every bit scintilla of information and in a fascinating tale that after you read this, you're dying to look up another Fred Rosen true crime classic for sure. So thank you very much, Fred. You have a great evening and good night.
Good night, Dan. Take care of yourself. Adios.
You too. You too. Thank you. Good night.